at 8 o'clock. Stay tuned. Coming up next at 5 p.m. will be Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. Stay tuned.
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, September 3rd, 2002. Block to block and house to house in Iraq and here at home. That's our program, the fourth in our month-long coverage of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. But before we do go into our program, an exciting one, and if you missed our prior shows, you can contact us for Pea Soup of Deception, the first two, and Reckless Endangerment, the third. But today we need your help, urgently, and to help free Claude Amaganvi. He's the spokesperson of the Workers' Party in Togo. Claude is somebody with whom Ralph and I have worked for many years on human and workers' rights issues, including the preparations for an international tribunal on the genocide of the peoples of Africa that was held in Los Angeles in February of 2000.
And with its preparatory session in Johannesburg, with the participation of trade unions and workers' organizations from over 14 countries in Africa.
Claude is now the spokesperson for the Workers' Party in Togo, West Africa. And when we had worked with Claude, we were really impressed by the courageous and meticulous research he did exposing the abuse of human rights and rampant torture in Togo. And with Claude, with the Workers' Party, has become the coordinator of a regroupment of political forces in Togo that's called What Solution for Togo. And in a move to decapitate this movement that calls for free and democratic elections in Togo, Claude has been arrested. He's being held in preventative detention, and when he goes to trial, faces at least 5 years imprisonment should he be convicted. And what he is accused of doing is distributing false information, defamation, and disturbance of public order. And what they mean by that is Claude is accused of writing an article that exposes the financial machinations, the
corruption and the theft of the President of the Republic.
Who was a general, President General Adeyemi. Now, Claude did not write this article. And in fact, the person who did write the article, who is the president of a political movement called the MO5, who lives in exile in Belgium and has put the article on the website called Togo Forum, he has come forward and acknowledged that he is the author of the article, and an article that was published in the Togolese newspaper, Le Nouvel Echo. Despite the fact that there is an affidavit from L.Y. Kusawo, the president of MO5, that Claude did not write the article, the Minister of Interior and Security is still holding Claude.
Now, Maya, of course, the article itself is a meticulously documented example of the prevalent crony capitalist fraud that is characteristic of these client regimes, as it is of American capitalism itself. But notwithstanding that, it's such a clear pretext, because Claude didn't happen to write the article, and they can't get at the guy who did because he's in exile, so they're deploying it as a pretext for attempting to decapitate this mass movement in Togo for the democratization of the society and for the exposure of the brutal nature of the regime in which Claude has been a principal figure.
Already, two professors, Dajura Tijgana and Takana Bajessa, were arrested and tried and sentenced for 1 year for just possession and distribution of leaflets. Imagine, for distributing leaflets, which have been distributed throughout Togo.
Where do they think they are? In the United States under Homeland Security?
And these are leaflets that are for What Solution for Togo that call for democratic elections. In the last election of 1998, when Edeyima was elected again, all the opposition parties had boycotted that election. Edeyima has been there since 67 in a military control of Togo. Now, Amnesty International in France has taken up Claude's case, as well as all the opposition parties. And trade union leaders, rank-and-file unionists, and organizations throughout the world, such as the CUT and the Workers' Party in Brazil and many African countries, are supporting the freedom, the liberation of Claude Amigdanvi. But we need your help, too. You can send a letter by email to Presidence, P-R-E-S-I-D-E-N-C-E, at Republic of Togo, one word, republicoftogo.com. Or you can send your support to us at Taking Aim at PacBell.net, and we will forward it on.
Copy us with your messages to the President of the Republic. This is an international movement. It's not only the risk of 5 years, but as Claude's own book on the torture that awaits political opponents makes clear, you don't survive those years in prison in Togo. His life is at stake. He's an extraordinary figure. His rights are indicative of the condition of the peoples of Togo and of Africa at large. We want to defend our brother and comrade in his fight to survive and to lead his people against this brutal regime and the international forces of the United States and that sustain such client regimes in power.
And now for Block to Block and House to House. That is the plans for urban warfare in Iraq and here at home. You may recall a week ago Monday, August 26th, Vice President Cheney, in speaking before the veterans of foreign wars, made clear that the U.S. invasion was on the agenda. In fact, over the past weeks, Ralph and I have been documenting the pincer movement of the bombardment of Iraq that has been going on by U.S. military warplanes and British warplanes as they try to squeeze the territory that the Iraqi government has under its control. And what Cheney said is, quote, "The risks of inaction are far greater than the risks of action." This is repeating the message that Condoleezza Rice gave to the BBC, and which Rumsfeld is also repeating. That's our Secretary of Defense, Rumsfeld, has been repeating. It is a message that if we don't do something, it'll be similar to the situation of when Hitler was in Germany. And in fact, Rumsfeld even goes so far as to state, quote, on Fox News, "Think of the prelude to World War II.
The shoe is on the other foot, Maya. Think of the venue, the location for Cheney's speeches, the National Convention of the Veterans of Foreign Wars in Nashville, Tennessee, the Korean War veterans in San Antonio, Texas, 3 days later. This is the real significance of this speech and its audience. This is an attempt to appeal to the military to back the attack force strategy for Iraq and the Middle East at large. This is an attempt to overwhelm the disaffection from leaders of the ruling class who are apprehensive about the destabilization of the region consequent upon the kind of perpetual war that is already on the drawing boards and that is underway in Iraq." Actually, if you look carefully at that speech, because it's a very significant speech, Cheney said that, quote, "There's a terrorist underworld out there spread among more than 60 countries, and that he quoted Rumsfeld as follows: "We are at the beginning of this war, far closer to the beginning than we are to its end. We have entered a struggle of years, a new kind of war against a new kind of enemy. They're talking about a continuing war. They're preparing the American people, and they're attempting to overcome resistance within the military itself to 30,000 casualties in Iraq as the little beginning of a continued war of occupation and the fragmentation of the Middle East. It is a bloodthirsty perspective. It cannot be sustained because we know, as the regime itself does, that it cannot continually subject the American people to this state terrorism without incurring the disaffection and wrath of the mass of our population. That urban warfare that they're talking about in Iraq is in preparation in the United States as well.
And you can read Dick Cheney's speech at www.whitehouse.gov and then look for the speeches of the vice president. In fact, Vice President Dick Cheney, as the mouthpiece for the Bush administration, has come forward and said, quote, "Saddam has perfected the game of cheat and retreat, and is very skilled in the art of denial and deception. A return of inspectors," that is Dick Cheney referring to the UN weapons inspectors, quote, "would provide no assurance whatsoever of his compliance with UN resolutions. On the contrary, there is a great danger that would provide false comfort that Saddam was somehow back in his box." In other words, Dick Cheney, without giving any evidence, comes to the conclusion, quote, "no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us. And there is no doubt that his aggressive regional ambitions will lead him into future confrontations with his neighbors, confrontations that will involve both the weapons he has today and the weapons he will continue to develop with his oil wealth." Well, Dick Cheney, we know that the real weapons of mass destruction are the weapons of the U.S. Pentagon, of the U.S. rulers that they used against Iraq, that they use against Afghanistan, and that they are preparing once again through mass saturation bombing to use against the Iraqi people.
In fact, The Orwellian deployment of the hit, in fact, it's not just Orwellian, it's Hitlerian. The repetition of the big lie. The orchestration of a total fiction. This is a devastated country. This is a country that has a regime that was imposed upon it by the United States. The origins of the regime of Saddam Hussein come with the counter-revolutionary overthrow of Abdulkarim Qasim when Saddam Hussein was the CIA asset involved in the 3 and 4 attempts to assassinate Abdulkarim Qasim that finally succeeded, after which the Arif regime proceeded to round up hundreds of thousands of people, and the executioner and the torture chamber supervisor directly operating under CIA mandate was none other than Saddam Hussein. This is a small country. It is a country of 17 million people. 17 million people.
With 5 million of them living in the capital city of Baghdad.
And to remind you, you talk about weapons of mass destruction. You talk about the threat to populations. The United Nations report by the Undersecretary General of the United Nations at the time of the Gulf War, Marty Ahtisaari, conveys what we are about to witness in Iraq. You know, I want to mention that with September 11th coming up, the media have been replete with the discussion of the trauma experienced by New Yorkers. Some 60% of the residents of New York are said to be still suffering psychological effects, post-traumatic response to the events of September 11th. And without in any way attempting to diminish the traumatic impact upon the American psyche of the collapse of the World Trade Center in New York, we should keep a somewhat comparative understanding of what the significance of this is. Frankly, brothers and sisters, we're talking about the destruction of two buildings on one day. And we are talking a year later about 60% of the population of the city of New York suffering traumatic psychological impact from that event. Here is Ahtisaari describing what happened to Iraq in 1991. Nothing that we had seen or read had prepared us for the particular form of devastation which has befallen this country. The bombing has wrought near apocalyptic results upon the infrastructure of what had been until 1991 a rather highly urbanized and mechanized society. Now, all means of modern life support have been destroyed and rendered tenuous. Iraq has been relegated to a pre-industrial age, but with all the disabilities of post-industrial dependency on an intensive use of energy and technology. His report describes the result of indiscriminate incineration through fuel air bombs and weapons which obliterated all means of sustenance for the civilian population of all of Iraq's major cities. The reservoirs and water pipes were targeted and disappeared in Iraq. Virtually all hygienic facilities were decimated. Electric power ceased. Iraq had no means to restore it for years. Neither water nor sewage could be conveyed. No pipelines remained. There was no power to pump the fluids. Civilian communications were destroyed. Transportation for the population obliterated. Roads, bridges, tunnels. All refineries reduced to rubble. The grain and food sheds and warehouses targeted and destroyed. Medicines, pharmaceutical products, bandages, antibiotics, the general hospital supplies, the surgical equipment for blood typing, blood supplies, anesthesia, and means of sterilization. Medical treatment, the report continues, for the population had come to an end. The banking system was destroyed. No one currency was available to buy such goods as still existed. The irrigation systems were obliterated. The organized agriculture, which depends upon them, had ceased to exist. Matasari continues in his report like a man in shock. These conditions mean that the authorities are scarcely able even to measure the dimensions of the calamity, much less respond to its consequences. We are talking about a society reduced to the 14th century. The Christian Aid Society of Great Britain calculated that 70,000 Iraqi children, 70,000 Iraqi children were killed just in the air bombardment of the Gulf War, and half of Iraq's population is under 15. The disease and starvation became so prevalent that it claimed hundreds of thousands of additional lives in the ensuing months, and the subsequent blockade and embargo and sanctions have taken the lives of another million children and 1.5 million civilians in Iraq. How can one begin to imagine the moral disconnect of this enormous genocidal onslaught inflicted on this small country, this third world country, this vulnerable country, this country suffering under a dictatorship imposed for 27 years by the United States and the Central Intelligence Agency. And now we are being prepared for 1,500 sorties a day of B-52s for a period of 8 weeks. They calculate for 8 weeks they are going to saturation bomb Iraq with high-firing magnesium bombs, with incendiary gel that sucks the oxygen out of the air, with implosion weapons that disintegrates everything that it strikes. These are the weapons of mass destruction. This is the genocide that is coming to visit the peoples of the world. It is coming to Iraq. It is coming to the region. It is coming from the American military. It is coming from Cheney and Bush, these war criminals. It is the inevitable destruction of a whole people that will require the suppression of our own in the United States.
Thomas L. Friedman, writing in the New York Times, September 1st, Iraq without Saddam, as Ralph likes to call Thomas Friedman,
the Hannibal Lecter of American journalism.
He writes, quote, "Invade Iraq and we own Iraq. And once we own it, we will have to rebuild it. And since this is a huge task, we will need to understand what kind of raw material we'll be working with." And when he talks about Iraq, he talks about cracking it like a nut.
Opening it like a walnut is his formulation in the New York Times.
Yes.
Opening Iraq like a walnut. And Maya, just let me mention that this man is the same person who coined the slogan, "Give War a Chance." And during the war in Yugoslavia, Thomas Friedman, the Hannibal Lecter of American journalism, called for a pulverization of the Serbian nation back to 1950. We can do 1389 as well. and he included amongst his proposed targets the Belgrade teenagers holding rock concerts and the families going out for Sunday merry-go-round rides. Steady as she goes was his column. He says our strategy is the right one, massed air power crippling the Serbian infrastructure. And he goes on to say the blunt truth is that more Serbs than ever support the regime's action. Hatred of Albanians is not something invented by Milosevic. It has deep roots in Serbian political culture. It is the same racist, imperial, gloating sensibility with which he now describes the Iraqi people. He said it's not Saddam Hussein, but he says this is a savage and murderous society. And he uses as evidence of their murderous capacity the very putches and coup d'etats that the Central Intelligence Agency inflicted upon the Iraqi people when they attempted to nationalize their oil. And he attributes to the Iraqis the murder of hundreds of thousands of students and intellectuals and trade unionists and peasant leaders, a murder that the Central Intelligence Agency, as the book Ropes of Sand by Wilbur Eveland so eloquently describes, with their main man in Baghdad, Saddam Hussein, as the vehicle for that devastation. These are the authors, and these are the apologists, and this is the scenario that is designed to whipsaw the American people into a numbed acquiescence in a horror about to unfold once again.
The New York Times on August 26th had more than a full page devoted to the war plans, the military plans, and an assessment of the Iraqi military and possible defense played out throughout the press, whether it's the New York Times or MSNBC or CNN or New York Post. Everywhere, all the media are following in lockstep with the Pentagon plans. And on the 26th, the headline reads, Iraq said to plan, tangling invaders in street plans. No hope in open battles. Strategy of scaring the U.S. by raising the political specter of house-to-house war. And it says, quote, Iraqi forces have been digging defensive positions for military equipment around Baghdad. And in quoting a former CIA analyst of the Iraqi military, Kenneth M. Pollack, the Times states, quote, Iraq has no hope of prevailing in a straight military fight. And after Desert Storm, the Iraqis probably realize that. And then Mr. Pollack goes on to say, and one way that the Iraqis can approach the U.S. is, one way to do that is to make us believe that we are going to face a Mesopotamian Stalingrad. In other words, the Iraqis are putting the U.S. in a position where the U.S. military will have to go block to block and house to house.
But before they do that, Maya, the block to block and the house to house is a description of a planned occupation of an entire country and the reconstruction of its politics on the basis of the surrender of 220 billion barrels of oil, the largest production outside of Saudi Arabia in the region. The Sunday Herald in London on the 1st of September, by an article by Felicity Arbuthnot, a slide from the impossible to the apocalyptic, and she invokes Martti Ahtisaari's report of 1991, and she remarks, since Ahtisaari's comments, Iraq has slid from the impossible to the apocalyptic. The UNICEF report, State of the World's Children, rates the country 11 points below Eritrea, with the highest increase in infant mortality on Earth. Waterborne diseases, and I'm quoting, such as cholera, typhoid, polio, have now become epidemic. They were eradicated by the Iraqi government prior to 1990. A child with dysentery in 1989 had 1 in 600 chances of dying. By 1999, it was 1 in 50. By today, it is 1 in 5. The World Health Organization estimates that each month an average of 5,000 children under 5 die as a result of the embargo. Last December, 11,000 people died as a consequence of the sanctions, and the majority of them children. And the article goes on about the total devastation of a society, malnourishment rampant, mothers too weak to breastfeed, unable to afford milk power, feeding babies sugared water or tea. They become wasted, bloated, and almost all die. The doctors call them sugar babies. This is the Iraq of today. What will the Iraq post-war and invasion once again be like? A devastated, genocidally destroyed society. That is the condition in which the house-to-house, the block-to-block, is to occur in Iraq.
And remember that each of these 1,000 to 1,500 bombing sorties, that means bombing raids, each plane dropping more than one bomb, what is contained in those bombs is depleted uranium. Depleted uranium, with the devastating effects that go on for generations and which we have documented in prior shows. But Ralph found a recent article about the Balkans War and the effect of depleted uranium that appeared in the New York Times.
Yesterday's New York Times, and it's called On a Balkan War's Last Day, Poison from the Sky. It's an article by Marlies Simons, and it says, protective clothing covers them from head to toe. The cape is marked with signs, radioactive danger, trespass is forbidden. The scientists from Montenegro are searching for the war debris, specifically the bullets coated with radioactively depleted uranium. The Americans fired hundreds of rounds at the cape on the final day. And the scientist says, we don't understand why anyone would want to attack and contaminate this place on the last day of the war, said Pirko Vukotic, the professor of nuclear physics at the University of Montenegro at Podgorica, who heads the 12-man team. Water corrodes the uranium and it becomes powdery. It crumbles like cigarette ash. It spreads in the soil. The people touch and inhale it. The wind blows it everywhere. NATO disclosed that it fired thousands of rounds of munitions with tips of depleted uranium, penetrating targets across Bosnia, Kosovo, and Serbia and Montenegro. Depleted of its most radioactive part for use in nuclear fuel, the material emits radiation. And we have described how this has caused an epidemic of thalidomide-like deformities and birth deformities across Iraq. Children born without limbs, without brains, with two heads. An epidemic that has destroyed the agriculture and which has poisoned the entire population because, as in Yugoslavia, so in Iraq, every cruise missile, every artillery round, the bullets themselves coated in depleted uranium, a form of tactical nuclear warfare which has permeated the aquifer. It has permeated the soil. It is disseminated by the winds through the air. It has caused a legacy of devastation for generations in Yugoslavia, as it has in Iraq. It is a little terrible, terrible beginning of what this new onslaught will visit upon Iraq and the region.
And as with articles in the New York Times, the one of which I spoke before, where it lays out possible battle plans, it's as if to present to the American people an intellectual abstract exercise, as if these war plans are but a chess game that they are playing at home to inure the people to the devastation that will be wrought upon the people of Iraq. And in the Wall Street Journal on August 22nd, an important article appeared that I hope you can look at. It's called Street Smarts by Greg Jaffe. And it's one of a series of reports that appeared throughout the newspapers and on National Public Radio, where the Pentagon has been giving access to reporters to go along with the Marines and the Special Forces and watch them in their training exercises in nothing other than urban warfare. And the article is, as threats evolve, Marines learn skill of combat in cities. They could need it in Iraq. An exercise reveals the cost of fighting house to house. And they stage a bloody assault on Al George. Now, these exercises were part of the Millennium 2002, exercises that took place with 16,000 military troops and war simulations, costing $250 million, a quarter of $1 billion, and taking place over 6 weeks. And Greg Jaffe writes in great detail about these exercises for one Marine unit that took place at George Air Force Base in Victorville, California. Now, this is an abandoned Air Force base. 980 Marines under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Michael Belcher. And it took place in June, over 5 weeks, block to block, fighting house to house in simulated urban combat against foes who had been coached, quote, in hit and run tactics of guerrilla fighters. And in this complete article, what you see is that they hired people like you or me to play the enemy fighters, and also they used certain Marine reservists. And what they did is teaching the troops to run down hallways to stay away from the sides because bullets tend to ricochet and travel against the walls, and then to use their electronic equipment. And what they found, though, is that the soldiers were being killed off. It didn't take much, and in fact, a lieutenant had to resurrect himself in order to prevent the entire death of all the Marines in the exercise. You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, and we're coming to you over WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, listener-sponsored radio, and on the Internet at www.wbai.org. You can reach us at our new email address, takingaim@pacbell.com. That's PACBELL.net, and Taking Aim is one word. Again, that's takingaim@pacbell.net. Or write to us at Veritas Press, V-E-R-I-T-A-S Press, Post Office Box 6345, Vallejo, V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California 94591, or call us at 707-552-9995. Ralph?
The state terrorism, which is the characteristic mode of rule of that 2% of our population that owns 90% of the wealth, the state terrorism is what this war against the people of Iraq represents. The terrorizing of an entire population, their devastation, the elimination of their infrastructure because of the lust for profits and the lust for oil, the lust for resources, the lust for sustaining a rotten and collapsed capitalist system. On the very eve of the attack of September 11th, $2.4 trillion are announced as having been lost and disappeared. Over 1,000 points had been lost on the New York Stock Exchange in the previous week. The scandals which we have now had orchestrated over the past year that demonstrate the nature of crony capitalism, the subject of this show, were preoccupying the American people. The working population was experiencing the consequence of deflecting all funds to the greedy maw of the Pentagon and its associated companies run by the Carlyle Group and the Bush cronies. On September 1st in the Sunday Herald, the article that appeared in London was the following. The CIA warns that hijacker signals a new wave of terror. The CIA believes the Islamic hijacker planning to crash a plane bound for Britain into a U.S. embassy is part of a new wave of terrorists ready to attack American targets in a run-up to the anniversary of the September 11th atrocities. Now, what is this about, brothers and sisters? It's about a Swedish man of Tunisian origin named Karim Chatti, who had been taking flying lessons in the U.S. state of South Carolina, according to Swedish police. Is that familiar? Every one of these accused terrorists is engaged in flying lessons at U.S. military schools, at U.S. intelligence-monitored flying schools in the United States. And he was arrested at Stockholm Airport on suspicion of planning a hijacking when he was found with a 6.5 millimeter pistol and carry-on luggage in his toilet article clip with 3 rounds of ammunition. Think about it. A sophisticated hijacker, he gets on board a plane and he has a 6.5 millimeter in his toilet article kit with 3 rounds of ammunition as he goes through the standard security check. Is that a setup or is that a setup? They are preparing us for the urban warfare that they intend to impose upon the United States as our working population, as the mass of our people begin to resist the body bags, begin to resist the state terrorism that defines this dying capitalism's attempts to impose its rule on the suffering peoples of the planet.
And meanwhile, as we mentioned before, the Pentagon has been taking reporters on a tour of all the preparations, and as if it's bringing into our living room, making all these killer squads part of the family. July 5th, getting special ops ready is the report of NPR, National Public Radio's David Moltis, who went along with the 2,200 men and women who specialize in the missions going so-called anti-terrorist assaults, which means the murder incorporated attacks that are planned for places like Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, these are the 24th Marine Expeditionary Units that come out of Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. And these expeditionary forces are deployed to Navy ships in the Mediterranean. And they can, within notice, get to any place within 6 hours. And that's called leaning forward. And there are a series of reports, and you can hear them on the internet at the NPR site, and very revealing of what they're doing. For instance, in one exercise, Moltis reports, the Marines run toward a rubber dummy attached to a pole. Quote, the young soldiers jab their bayonets into the dummy's neck, face, or groin before twisting the blade and pulling it out quickly. In another drill, Marines take turns flipping a running attacker flat on his back on the hard clay turf of an athletic field. In other words, they're training them to be efficient killer squads.
In that regard, Maya, this urban warfare that is being planned not just for Iraq but for the United States itself is illuminated by an ABC News report by Andrew Chang on August 6th called Secret Wars, Special Op Forces May Soon Undertake Covert Missions of a Different Kind. Last month, a highly classified memo leaked from the Pentagon indicated that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was ordering Special Operations Command to engage in covert missions to capture or kill leaders of terrorist organizations. That means, ABC says, that special operations teams will operate in countries where the local government is not informed of their presence, and if they are caught, they will not be recognized as Americans. ABC's news consultant, former CIA counterterrorism chief Vince Canestaro, said what Rumsfeld has ordered was unusual because special ops members were engaged in missions as demanding and secretive as what would be required to kill people wherever they are in progress. The missions proposed by Rumsfeld are covert, which means the sponsoring role of the government is hidden. A clandestine operation hides the activity itself. The CIA has been given specific funding for special ops members in these assassination missions, which are to unfold in countries across the world without their knowledge, without their being informed, without any acceptance on the part of the regime here itself for its murder squads that are indiscriminate and random. And the definition of who and what is a terrorist, of course, is made by the likes of Rumsfeld and Cheney and Ashcroft. Brothers and sisters, what is intended abroad is planned for the United States
And we'll go into that very soon. Meanwhile, a little bit more about MOOT, That's the military operations in urban terrain. High tech, a lot of money that comes from the military-industrial complex for special radios, special suits, special guns. Yet, in a revealing article that appeared on WashingtonPost.com from AP military writer Robert Burns on Friday, August 16th, states, quote, ex-general says war games were rigged. And the retired general, Marine Corps Combat Development Command leader, Paul Van Ripper, who retired in 1997, had been chosen to command the, quote, enemy forces in the Millennium Challenge 2002. And what Ripper said, in actuality, was an exercise that was entirely scripted to ensure a blue, that is, the friendly forces win. And in fact, what happened was that in these simulations, Ripper, as the head of the enemy forces, was able to destroy the U.S. forces. And so they had to redo the simulations because, as later appeared in all the press, it showed that should there be a war scenario and should there be urban warfare, the U.S. would have not the casualties that had been anticipated and would be victorious. And yet here you have, in the actual war games, when they weren't rigged, the U.S. forces were going to have mass casualties.
Well, actually what they're talking about in this regard is that after they devastate and utterly destroy societies as they have in Afghanistan, as they did in Iraq, as they inflicted upon Somalia, then they send in the occupying troops and the population, the surviving population, consumed with a hatred for the occupying Nazi-like forces that have destroyed their country, will resist. They will resist with everything at their disposal. And if this is not a clear scenario for what is intended abroad in this perpetual war, consider what they are preparing for us at home. Disturbing the peace. This isn't the first time the military has practiced war in U.S. cities. The San Francisco Bay Guardian, March 10, 1999. One nation under guard. The Marine Corps is making plans to take over U.S. cities during popular insurrections. They are practicing in Oakland next week. East Bay city leaders have been pressed to approve Urban Warrior over protests from citizens, neighbors, and environmentalists. And the San Francisco Bay Guardian 3 years ago documents how on February 8, 1999, a squadron of Black Hawk helicopters flying at treetop level dropped elite special operations soldiers into the center of Kingsville, Texas. For the next 2 hours, the Army's Delta Force and Night Stalkers conduct a battle with live ammunition, real explosives that set buildings on fire. Elderly residents relaxing on benches outside a retirement home watched in disbelief as explosions blew out the windows of office buildings nearby. Army officials subsequently confirmed that the soldiers had used live ammunition within hundreds of feet of startled civilians. The official emphasized that the troops were using training ammo, but they proved to be live ammunition. The only people in Kingsville who knew about this surprise raid, codenamed Operation Last Dance, beforehand were the mayor, the city manager, and the police chief. And the Fort Bragg Army Special Operations Command spokesperson, Walt Sokalski, confirmed that they were using live ammunition and that this was a preparation raid. And in May 1998, San Antonio became aware of a U.S. Army urban warfare operation in the city. And the city mayor in that instance refused to go along. The Army continued with the war games in the vicinity of San Antonio. The same month, the U.S. Marine Corps brought their Urban Warrior Act to Chicago, says the San Francisco Bay Guardian. We couldn't have picked a better city, Marine Public Affairs Officer Lieutenant Colonel Jenny Holbert told the Chicago Sun-Times. During the exercise, Marines occupied Chicago's bridges, tunnels, subways, sewers, water treatment plants, and electrical and communication systems. In Pittsburgh in 1996, Army choppers and troops from the Special Operations Command turned sections of Pittsburgh into a war zone, terrifying residents with gunfire and explosions, sending women into premature labor. Pittsburgh police were besieged with calls from fearful and angry citizens. The remainder of the operation, scheduled to last a week, had to be canceled because of the public's outrage. And indeed, the Ian Williams Goddard wrote at the time in the Washington Times, "It is outrageous to give only a few hours' warning to communities. It shows utter disregard for the sovereignty and dignity of the people and the communities of the United States. This is an act of intimidation. It is an effort to teach our people to tolerate military occupation." The Washington Times, 1996, brothers and sisters. And sending in the troops, the East Bay city leaders rushed to approve Urban Warrior over the protests of citizens. That is the context in which a series of such operations has been carried out across the United States over the past decade.
In over 20 U.S. cities, the U.S. Army Special Operations Command carried on urban warfare under the moniker Cauldron Chariot. Among the cities were, as Ralph said, Oakland, and then Atlanta, Chicago, Dallas, Houston, Los Angeles, New Orleans, Miami, Pittsburgh, Charlotte, and Seattle among them. And the combat exercises in Charlotte, North Carolina, which took place March 4th, 1997, that's under the Clinton administration, are illustrative. Charlotte Mayor Patrick McCrory, in a letter to then-President Clinton, described the scene. A dozen Black Hawk helicopters descended into the city. The craft disgorged the Special Forces troops, who laid siege to empty buildings with snipers on rooftops firing rifles with live ammunition, while other troops set off explosions, blowing off the buildings. And in Columbia, South Carolina, the Special Forces took over the Five Points Restaurant Row area in downtown Columbia, South Carolina, which is the center of nightlife, and they were using their urban warfare exercises. And there, it wasn't just one day. They extended what were to be 1 week of occupation to a month or more. Ralph?
Project Metropolis brings urban wars to U.S. cities. This is an article in the magazine called National Defense. National Defense, the ability to disable a city's critical infrastructure, its communications, and its transportation grids, is one example of the new skills that the Marines are practicing in urban warfare exercises. In a recent live exercise in North Little Rock, Arkansas, Marines from the 4th Expeditionary Brigade headquarters conducted what is known as a staff ride, occupying key infrastructure sites, telecommunications, water, power, rail transport, nuclear power facilities, developing, quote, tactics and techniques to protect and destroy key infrastructure to take control of it, said Brigadier General Douglas Odell, commander of the brigade, the Corps' elite anti-terrorism unit. Odell spoke to National Defense during the exercise in North Little Rock, part of the larger Marine Corps Warfighting Laboratory Urban Warfare Training Initiative called Project Metropolis. This is a plan of occupation in the United States itself. This is the preparation for martial law. This is the intended response to a resistance to the perpetual war. This is the means through which the staged second and third terror attacks on the United States, staged by the U.S. government itself, will become the rationale and the pretext for the occupation of our cities by our Marines, our Special Forces, our military. In the past 20 years, 21 out of 26 U.S. military operations, and I'm quoting from the National Defense article, had an urban context, 10 of them exclusively in cities and urban environments in the United States.
We have spoken before of garden plot. Garden plot is the doctrine in the Department of Defense that allows the armed forces to step in and take control of civilian affairs, quote, following a catastrophic event if the president requested it. And it is a defense condition, DEFCON, which is the step-by-step system for military involvement here in the United States, and it's called the Civilian Disorder Condition, or CIDCOM, C-I-D-C-O-N. And with garden plot, it's a doctrine that gives the president the power to invoke martial law under what is known as the Insurrection Act. And aside from these Marine Expeditionary Forces and the Special Forces at Fort Bragg, there is Task Force 250, which is the Army's 82nd Airborne, and that also is at Fort Bragg, and as well the Joint Task Force Civil Support based at Fort Monroe in Virginia. And that is why it was so important to the U.S. rulers to set up the Northern Command. Previously, there had been no unified military command that dealt with the United States itself. And during the Clinton administration, they tried to set up the Northern Command and weren't able to. But after September 11th, immediately they pushed through the Northern Command with U.S. Air Force General Ralph Eberhardt as its director. And the Northern Command oversees all military personnel patrolling American cities, patrolling the waters up to 500 miles off the U.S. coast, and has overall command of these military forces of which we were speaking that would be used in the urban warfare against the workers, the people of the United States.
And there's no ambiguity about that. This Bay Guardian expose, One Nation Under Guard, is explicit. The Marine Corps is making plans to take over U.S. cities during popular insurrections. Forget the Middle East. Forget Kosovo. The U.S. Marine Corps is convinced its next major invasion will take place on the west coast of the United States. That's right. The Marines are preparing to put down insurrection in major American cities, San Francisco, Seattle, Los Angeles, dubbed urban warfare, advanced warfare fighting. And any pretext that this is anything to do with humanitarian assistance to victims of a presumptive terror attacks is discarded. A review of hundreds of pages of documents, this is the Bay Guardian, regarding urban warfare plans around the country, reveal no plans for providing any humanitarian assistance. In fact, Marine Corps documents explain the Bay Area operation will pit an enhanced combat operations center in a design to penetrate, thrust, and swarm into urban settings to seize their power plants, their TV and radio stations, their food and water supplies, to suppress any local opposition, and ultimately to control these cities, quote unquote. Brothers and sisters, this is not a new design. The military internment of U.S. civilians, which has been prepared by the Director of Resource Management, is not only something that was prepared under FEMA, as we have documented over a period of time, which was originally the Federal Emergency Military Administration, but Congressman Henry Gonzalez, the Democrat from Texas, clarified the question of, quote, the existence of civilian detention camps, and he stated, quote, the truth is yes. You have to stand by these, you do have these standby provisions. The plans are here. In the name of stopping terrorism, there will be the military arrest of Americans and their placement in detention camps. That's a quote from Henry Gonzalez, and it has a long antecedent preparation. On August 3rd, 1948, J. Edgar Hoover met with Attorney General J. Howard McGrath to form a plan whereby President Truman would suspend constitutional liberties during a national emergency. The plan was codenamed Security Portfolio. It authorized the FBI to arrest summarily over 20,000 persons and place them in national security detention centers. Congress then repealed the Emergency Detention Act of 1950, but 20 years later, it was reenacted. And indeed, the Senate held hearings in December 1975 revealing that the ongoing internment plan had never been terminated. Entitled Intelligence Activities, Senate Resolution 21, it disclosed the covert agenda. In a series of memos, documents, and testimony by government informants, the picture emerged of the designs by the federal government to monitor, infiltrate, arrest, and incarcerate a large segment of American society.
Before we run out of time, our program on Block to Block and House to House, I want to remind you to send your protest letters for Claude Amaganzi to Presidence, Presidence, at Republic of Togo, one word, republicoftogo.com, and also a copy to us at Taking Aim at PacBell, PacBell.net. And I don't want us to close this program, Ralph, without that important article you found that actually sets the date for the large-scale invasion of Iraq, November 30th, the attack.
Thank you, Maya. Actually, this the article is September 1st. It's in the New York Post, and it says, "Hey, Saddam, circle November 30th. We're coming to get you. The United States will launch," this is the article in the New York Post, "its all-out attack to oust and kill Saddam Hussein." Israeli military sources, quoted by the respected Israeli newspaper Maariv, disclosed that the U.S. military delegation has revealed the plans in briefings with Israeli and Jordanian military officers. The chairing U.S. officer told the Israelis that President Bush has decided to kill Saddam. The assault will begin with a massive attack from the air and from the sea. And the World Tribune, on the 30th August, reported, "U.S. general tells Israelis the war will start by late November." The two countries discussed Israel's role in the attack, and that role is illuminated by Ali Abu Niba's citation of a report of Gamla, founded by the Israeli military officers, which prepares for the transfer, the mass ethnic cleansing of every Palestinian, the context of which will require massive invasion of Lebanon, massive invasion of Jordan by the Israeli forces into the cover of an American onslaught on Iraq, the ongoing preparations to dismantle the regimes of the Middle East and fragment each country in their turn, as the oil is seized, as the region is destroyed, as the perpetual war is unfolded, and as our freedom in the United States is made into a vanishing dream. We will resist this, brothers and sisters. We must mobilize our people, our trade unions, our labor organizations at the point of production have to understand that it is they who are the ultimate target. We, our people, are threatened no less than the people of Iraq. It is a war against the populations of the world by this genocidal elite, this ruling class of the United States.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman.
And Maya Schoen will be with you next week.
That was Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen, Tuesdays at 5 p.m. on WBAI, listener-sponsored commercial-free radio at 99.5 FM on the Internet at WBAI.org. Thanks for tuning in. Coming up at 6 o'clock will be a report of the day's news with the WBAI news team. At 7 o'clock, Tahrir, produced by Barbara Nimri Aziz. And on today's program, this evening's program, she'll be hosting Arab comedian May soon she'll be on with Barbara Nimri Aziz. She is a stand-up comic performing in the New Jersey, New York area, New Jersey and New York, as well as Connecticut, I do believe. So tune in for that at 7 p.m. The Asia Pacific Forum at 8 o'clock. Jazz Sampler with Bill Ferrara at 9 o'clock. Coming up at midnight, the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. And just before we go to the evening news, we'll give you just a preview of what will happen at midnight. Stay tuned.
Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Anarchism for the global city. Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle. Esoteric